Coming up on Digital Music Trends 179 on the 16th of April 2014, the Gramophone, Deezer's new features and Samsung partnership, Spotify's partnership with Sprint, Smule's new round, Universal Music buys Eagle Rock, Pono's 6.2 million Kickstarter, Kim.com's new lawsuits and asset win, P2P in Spain, and a chat with Deborah Newman on the latest developments in the rate court proceedings for internet radio services in the US. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Lunelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available on a variety of channels including iTunes and most podcatching apps including Downcast, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud and many more. And if you'd like to receive a weekly mail out with a lowdown on the latest shows, you can sign up right from the homepage or go to bit.ly/DMTlist. So again, it's bit.ly/DMTlist. And if you want to comment on something we talked about on the show, you can tweet us on @DigiMusicTrends or email contact@DigitalMusicTrends.com. Your feedback and word of mouth is essential to making sure the show goes out to as many people as possible, so please do share it if you enjoyed it this week. And this week, it's a real pleasure to welcome two great guests to the show. So Andy Malt, editor of Complete Music Update, or CMU, which produces some great weekly features and daily features on the music industry. So hi, Andy, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Hi, thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you. And so, and of course, I can't have you on without mentioning the CMU Daily, which is your daily newsletter, which is free to sign up to. Yeah. And that's on the website, which is completemusicupdate.com. And also, you have a premium subscription now, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the premium subscription, the daily newsletter goes out and there's a massive daily roundup of everything that's happened in the last 24 hours. The premium subscription is kind of a more of a digest, like a weekly focus on what the big developing stories and things are coming the week. And then we also have a monthly kind of really in-depth report that goes out to people who sign up for that.
Awesome. And it's also a great pleasure to welcome back Steve Knopper on the show. Steve writes for Rolling Stone, is the author of the music industry book Appetite for Self-Destruction, which if you haven't read that, you need to go and buy on Amazon right now, and is currently writing the ultimate Michael Jackson biography. So hi, Steve, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Good. Thanks, Andrea, for having me. Always nice to be back here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And so this week we're going to open up actually by talking about a hardware project on Kickstarter. And no, it is not the Pono. We're going to talk about the Pono, but not quite yet, later on in the show. And so the Kickstarter project is raising $250,000 to fund the Gramophone. So the Gramophone is a new hardware project led by the founder of the Phone Wireless Routers company, Martin Varsavsky. So Phone has created a network of 13 million wireless routers around the world, which act both as Wi-Fi hotspots for the people that have it in their home, and also as a means to share your internet with the world. So in turn, if you do have this device and share your internet, then you can use phone hotspots around the world, which is pretty handy if you're traveling. So the Gramophone is kind of an extension of that device, and it's completely focused on music. It's a small square box that can be connected to your existing network and then connects to your sound system via a good old-fashioned lead, allowing people that come to your house to share your internet connection, and but also share into your music playing opportunities, so they can play music through your device. And of course, you yourself, through the application on your phone, can play music through the device on your speakers. The cool thing about it is that it's Wi-Fi driven and it pulls music directly from the cloud, so there's no issues with the Bluetooth connections or issues with the connection between your phone and the device disrupting the music listening experience, like calls or messages or anything like that. So the device has started at $30 for the very, very early backers, and now it's around $50 for the remaining time. It's raised around $80,000 right now, so it's doing pretty well. A second, you know, less than 48 hours out of the bag on Kickstarter, with 28 days to go, and so it looks like it will hit the target unless things slow down dramatically. And so guys, let me know your thoughts. You know, it's an interesting play. It's really one of the first things that seems to challenge the Sonos, in the sense that it's a device that does something similar but doesn't have the speakers, so it's just the device itself, and it's a very low price point. So what are your thoughts, Andy?
Yeah, I think it's great, because I mean, I look at Sonos kind of every couple of months and think, yeah, I can't really justify paying money for that. I live in quite a small flat. I don't need all my rooms connected up. But this, like, you know, I looked at it on Kickstarter and I wasn't really sure if I needed it, but it's so cheap, I might as well have one, really.
Exactly.
You know, it's like it only works with Spotify at the moment. Obviously, it's only got kind of, it's not got the functionality that Sonos does. But as a little device that you just connect to your hi-fi, and, you know, I've got quite an old hi-fi, so that's quite good for me.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, your friends can connect to it, your friends can connect. Yeah. And, you know, your friends can connect to it, and your friends can connect to your Wi-Fi through it without you having to find the bit of paper with your password written on it. It seems like a really kind of useful thing.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that, you know, if you are a music lover, you probably at some point in your life you have bought a pair of like half decent speakers, but now it seems like, you know, there's no device with which you can play music through those speakers, and you have to go and buy a whole new set of speakers, which is not the greatest thing in the world. But Steve, on your end, are you convinced by the Gramophone? Do you think it's a project that has got some legs?
I do. I mean, I think that the model is really interesting, but I'm having trouble seeing how it differs from the system that I'm currently using in my house, which is just basically my iPhone and the remote app and, you know, a couple of Apple AirTalk Expresses. You know, I basically plug those in to the outlet and connect them to my Wi-Fi and plug them into my speakers. And using AirPlay, I can get Spotify and I can stream my entire, you know, iTunes collection and so forth. I realize I'm being very Apple-centric here, but...
Sure, of course.
You know, that works great for me. I find that all I need is two or three different pairs of speakers. And like Andy, I have considered going Sonos for a while, but can't really justify the expense. So this method is much cheaper. And the whole Gramophone model seems interesting to me. And I especially am interested in sort of their unique approach to Wi-Fi networks. But
yeah.
I can't really quite see it being practical enough that I would pay to upgrade from what I have currently, which I like.
Sure. Exactly. And you know, you got the...
Sorry, I was going to say, I mean, I have a similar thing at the moment. Like, obviously, it's only Spotify, and at the moment, I pretty much do the same thing, I guess. I plug my phone in, and then I can control what's happening on my phone on Spotify with the app on my iPad. So I'm not, you know, it's not a massive change to what I'm doing at the moment, but it was interesting enough and cheap enough that I thought, well, I'd quite like to see that and see how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I pledged for it I was in on it early, and so I got the $30 device, which is really you know, it's nothing. So it's definitely worth it to check it out. And I guess, like, the one thing, the cool thing about it, and it could be also quite creepy, depends on like how people take it, is the fact that your friends that come to your house, if they are your Facebook friends, they're automatically allowed onto the Wi-Fi network without having to give them a password or anything, and they're also automatically allowed to play music on your device. So that could be a good thing or a terrible thing, depending on how good your friend's music
is. Does that mean if you have a party everybody's fighting for the music and the music is constantly changing, like, no, 2 seconds of this, no, 2 seconds of that?
That could be the case. I don't know what kind of controls they're putting into place. I think they do have a control where you just kick everybody out and just say, no, I'm sorting out the music for now, if you get to that stage. But it's definitely something that I'm sure they're going to have to build into the platform. It seems pretty cool. It's definitely a weird entry because, you know, it's a company that hasn't been in the music space ever before, but it is definitely very grounded in the Wi-Fi space. And if I get this device and I can also access a bunch of hotspots around the world, that's not bad. I mean, even here in my house, I can see there's a BT with Fon Wi-Fi network that I can see from here. They must have some sort of partnership with BT, so it's definitely something that could be pretty cool if it is available internationally. Of course, that's also a way for them to break the US market, because they haven't really done a lot in the US yet. So if they can get a bunch of people to buy the device in the US, then that would definitely increase the chances of a network spreading over there as well. But yeah, we'll see what happens. We've still got 28 days to go, but it looks pretty good right now. Usually if a project hits sort of the 20-25% in the first couple of days, it's a very good chance that it's going to get funded. So we'll see what happens on that front. One more story that is actually has nothing to do with this, so I can't even do a segue. I'm trying really hard. But I want to talk about Deezer. So Deezer sent like a huge press release last week. It was like 3 pages long with a bunch of different announcements. So we're going to have to tackle them one by one and just talk about them, breaking them up a little bit. So first of all, the company has introduced two new features. features. The first one is called Flow, and it creates a personalized radio station based on the user's streams on Deezer and on their own music library. So you can do six skips an hour, and it's free from any time restriction and available to all Deezer users, free and premium. So that's an interesting development. The second feature is another radio one, and it's called Playlist Radio, which is going to be available only to free users and will be ad-supported, and it will include tracks from users' favorite playlists combined with tracks recommended by Deezer's editorial team. So first of all, a radio play here, and the second big announcement was the fact that Deezer is removing all time limits on desktops and tablets for on-demand access around the world for the free version. So that's really interesting, because of course Deezer is a company with the most presence worldwide as far as streaming services are concerned. And finally, Deezer is unifying users' music collections with a new beta for the Mac client on the Deezer Mac client. So it's going to be a bit like Spotify. You can have your own collection on the client as well as Deezer's collection. So let's look at the global footprint of Deezer first of all. Do you think that the fact that they're removing all these restrictions and that the service is going to be freely available around the world for users that are not paying as well is going to allow them to get a foothold in markets where Spotify, for example, is not present yet? And how much can that contribute to the company's success? Steve?
I guess let me start by asking you kind of a dumb question. Is Deezer now available in the U.S. or is that?
Not. It's not yet.
It's not. Okay.
They keep saying that they're planning to launch there. Sorry, they
right.
keep saying that.
So being American, it's It's hard for me to answer because I've never used Deezer before, and so you know my thoughts are really very American centric, I'm afraid, and you know the idea of Deezer launching here. It seems like they would have a ton of competition already with Spotify and Beats and iTunes Radio and Pandora. And these new features that you're describing are interesting, but it's kind of like they're establishing themselves elsewhere to kind of make up for things that are already available here. So I'm not, globally, I think they have a great niche and a great business market, and I think they'll do fine. In the U.S., I think it'll be a struggle unless they can really distance themselves or distinguish themselves from the others in some way.
Absolutely. And Andy, like that kind of brings us to the question, like these features really look like, a lot like what Spotify has been producing over the last months.
Yeah, right? they seem more like just catching up rather than kind of doing something really new and exciting. But I think, talking about the US, Deezer made a big deal of not launching in the US a couple of years ago and saying, like, even then, that was about 2012, I think, maybe 2011 even, saying that, the market was saturated and there was too much competition and there was no point trying to enter the US. And now there's been kind of talk of them, partnering with Samsung to get into the US at some point this year, which possibly is what the Galaxy partnership is about, really. I never get excited about Deezer. I find it really hard to get excited about Deezer. It's kind of, I know they claim to be the original kind of streaming service as we currently know them, and they claim to have huge numbers of users. But I mean, they also are the service that's done a huge number of telecoms deals. So you never really know how many of those users are people who have got a free account with their mobile contract and have no idea that it's there. I don't know. Deezer's Deezer, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Like, I signed up once again after I hadn't used the service for a long time, and it does seem like to have a lot of focus on curation. I received a fair amount of emails already from the company around things they were suggesting for me to listen to and things that I might like, and they seem to be pretty good recommendations. So on that front, I think it's a positive feedback on the experience so far. But I'm just so used to all the features on Spotify now that it's hard to kind of make the shift properly. Talking about the Samsung partnership, that's a super interesting thing, because Samsung is it's kind of been really shifting strategy all the time when it comes to its digital music properties. And in the US, it launched Milk, which is based on Slacker's technology, Slacker Radio, which is a free radio station for Samsung customers, essentially, based on music. It's a kind of a Pandora-like station. Milk, though, I guess, wouldn't be available in Europe because of licensing restrictions. Slacker is not available in Europe, and it would be a massive headache for them to export the service here. So maybe that's where the Deezer partnership comes in. So the partnership means that people that are going to buy a smartphone from Samsung over the next a few months, or as long as the partnership goes on for, they're going to get 6 months worth of Premium Plus Deezer service, which includes high quality streaming up to 320 kilobytes per second. And it will be it will start with a promotion of the Galaxy S5. So interesting to see here whether it's going to remain just a European thing or whether it's going to expand or not. And also another interesting thing is the fact that we haven't really seen a device maker including music as their own service since the debacle of Nokia's Comes With Music. So Steve, do you feel like there is still space here for device makers to successfully introduce their customers to new services, or is that era dead and gone and carriers are what it's all about?
Well, this particular service, as I'm reading about it, Milk seems to be very Pandora-like, and right. So my feeling is that just on that level alone, not to deal with your broader question, especially if people are paying for it, it would have to be something that is a value add above Pandora.
Right. Milk is always going to be free, and I think ad-free as well, possibly.
I see. Okay, so that's good. But still, I feel like Pandora is pretty well established, especially in the U.S., and I feel like if people are very loyal to Pandora, too. Yeah. So I think that if you're going to come in and kind of do more or less the same thing that Pandora does, especially if you're as part of a device, if you're exclusive to one particular device, you really have to add some things.
Yeah.
And just the service being great, I don't think that's enough. I think you're going to have to say, we have a new Jay-Z album, or we have a Beyonce album, something that you can't get from Pandora.
Yeah.
If those sorts of things start to happen, which is sort of what I thought would happen with Nokia's Comes With Music a few years ago, because they had all those connections and a lot of money and clout. If those things start to happen, I think that you could really have something. But I don't know, with Deezer's track record, like Andy was saying, it's Deezer, are they really going to do exciting, sexy things? I don't see that happening, but yeah. But never say never. Services surprise me all the time.
Andy, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the European launch of the Galaxy S5 with Deezer built in.
Yeah.
I guess the 100%, it all comes down to how this is implemented, because if you just put like a slip in a box with saying you get free Deezer for 6 months, that's not really going to drive people to really use it. They must do something more in terms of awareness in order for people to really catch on to the fact that they're getting free music with this phone. So what could that look like for you?
Yeah, well, I guess like with Spotify, with their Vodafone hookup, you have to opt into it, and it's like you get a choice between Spotify and Sky Sports, and that like is very much an active thing. Whereas I think a lot of these telecoms partnerships, with not just Deezer, but Deezer's obviously been a big one in doing these kind of partnerships. It is a passive thing, and most people aren't going to even realize that they've got this thing. But yeah. Deezer are still saying we've got all these users. I think it's interesting, possibly like if the Samsung thing was related to a US launch. There's not a lot of good mobile networks to partner with in the US. They've kind of been hoovered, so maybe going down a hardware partnership does make sense if that's the route they're going to go down.
Yeah, sure.
But like we say, whatever they do, there's a lot of competition. I don't know. We say this every year, but I think we're getting to a point now where it's getting very interesting, and I think we're going to start seeing more people dropping out of the game because it is getting very competitive and very tight.
Yeah. And another
getting thing. Bought.
Sorry? Getting bought.
Or getting bought. More
or getting bought. Yeah. Well, this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be interesting also because, a move like Deezer's to offer free music unlimited in 180 countries, that's a very expensive move. Regardless of the fact that they haven't launched in the US, it's still going to cost them a lot of money in royalties. So definitely interesting to see how that increases their burn and, their need to raise another round in the long term as well. And Steve, talking about carrier partnerships, like Andy was saying, the space in the US is kind of becoming much more restricted now. Spotify has been reported by Peter Kafka Recode, which is who is always very reliable. So I trust his sources. He reports that Spotify has closed the deal with Sprint to bundle the music streaming services with a mobile carrier's plan. So Sprint has got over 50 million customers in the US. It's the third carrier by size after AT&T and Verizon. AT&T, of course, has gone with Beats Music. Verizon hasn't really, I don't think, made a choice yet. It feels like on their website they push Rhapsody more than anything else, but that might be like still a bit of a question mark when it comes to partnerships. So what do you reckon is going to happen in the US market? And do you think that carriers are going to be open to having multiple streaming partners, or is Beats Music going to be with AT&T exclusively and Spotify going to be with Sprint exclusively?
Well, I guess my best way of answering that would be from the consumer perspective. Yeah. My family has three phones. One's AT&T and two are Verizon. And so I've had one Spotify account for many years now. My other two people in my family are frustrated with that because they can't get it on their phones, you know. So we were excited about Beats because at first we thought, okay, well, we'll just pay $15 a month instead of three separate $10 subscriptions and get the family plan. But then it turns out that it's not available on there for Verizon phones, and then you still have to pay 10 and then 10 and then 10. It's too confusing, and it seems too expensive.
Right.
Although it's a little perverse to say $30 a month for all the music in the world is expensive. But nonetheless, that's sort of the rate, that the going rate right now. But so I guess to answer your question in a more simplified way, it's just got to play out. It's just got to shake out in terms of all these different phone services hooking up with a particular music app, streaming music app, to make it simple and to make it relatively cheap for the user.
Yeah.
I mean, I would do that. If I could pay $15 for either Beats or Spotify, or even $20 a month, probably. That seems like a bit of a stretch for wider consumer adoption. But if I could pay that amount and get that app, that service on each of my family's three phones, I would do it in a second.
Yeah.
And that would make my daughter and my wife really, really happy. And we could all be happy listening to music all the time together, you know? And I feel like that's not what's happening now. This seems a little bit like, remember those pre-iTunes downloading days when it was sort of like, well, this guy's going to do it this way. And if you happen to have this, then this will do it this way, until it's all congealed into like, oh, okay, iTunes does everything for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, that it feels like we're leading up to something, and this is still a little bit sort of the Wild West, if you will.
Yeah, we talked about the partnership between Spotify and The Times, for example, a few weeks ago, that gives free access to subscribers of The Times in the UK to Spotify. So do you think we're just seeing the beginnings of a bunch of different media deals that are going?
I do. I mean, I think that streaming music is something that is incredibly valuable, and these services that have the deals for the content are sitting on, you know, kind of a gold mine, although, you know, they obviously have to pay a lot for the content.
Yeah.
But it's valuable to a lot, not only media outlets, but mobile carriers. And there, I can see, you know, Ticketmaster, I can see all kinds of bundling opportunities here. And I think that's what we're headed towards.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of like, you know, go to Target and get a month free of Spotify, you know, or whatever it is, you know, buy a Ford car and get Spotify as part of your radio, you know, all these things, they're all coming together. And I think eventually, probably soon, the power of streaming is really going to start to come out, and it's going to seem much less like a niche the way it is now.
Yeah. Andy, what are your thoughts? And do you think that it's going to continue in the UK as well?
Yeah. I think partly these partnerships, I mean, they make sense for the streaming services because they get a different audience. Like, you know, the Times deal, that was like, you know, a year, was it a year free with your subscription?
Yeah, that's
like
right.
It was a long subscription, and that, you know, and part of the problem with all these services is that for a lot of people, you know, a week or a month isn't long enough to really get into that service. And particularly now, like, the people who have not signed up to those services are people who are going to be harder to get.
Yeah.
And if you get someone to use that for a year, and then at the end of the year say, actually, now you've got to give us £10 a month, you know, that's long enough for them to kind of understand what it is and get all their playlists up and getting ingrained into and really hook them in. And then similarly, like the family deals, you know, if you can hook an entire family in, you know, their kids are going to grow up and go and get accounts for their families. It'll be like, you know, spawning new users. yeah, I think those deals definitely make sense for the streaming services, and in terms of the people they do the deals with, I guess it depends on whether it kind of brings in new users and makes their current, you know, customers feel like they're getting something of value on top of what they already have with their accounts.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And one of the areas that I'm really interested in seeing how it develops is the cable slash TV operators. I mean, TV operators in the UK and cable operators in the US. We haven't really seen a great deal of partnerships going on that front. I don't think Sky has got an official streaming partner here in the UK, unless I'm mistaken.
I don't think so.
And likewise, Comcast, I don't think they have a service they are pushing, right? Steve?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either.
Is it a service on Comcast?
Sorry?
Are you saying a music streaming service
available via
Comcast? I don't believe there is one.
So that could be like a huge pool of users, potential mainstream users that those companies could hook if they could find a way to do deals with the big cable providers. But then again, cable providers already have their own problems.
Yeah. Well, I think Sky are still they're still, you know, a bit sad about what happened to Sky Songs.
That's still in the mourning period.
Yeah, give it time.
Yeah, as long as they can get up the black clothes, then it'll be fine. that's going to be one to watch for sure. And the other interesting story of this week was the fundraise of Smule. So Smule is a company that's kind of like still under the radar in a sense. Like, you know, we're not really talking about Smule all the time, but it is one of the probably the only company that's really managed to create a big business out of music apps. They've got 150 million users across all of their apps. The company's famous for Magic Piano, AutoRap, IMT Pain, and Sync Karaoke, amongst other apps. You know, their users are creating a ton of content all the time. They're creating their own communities. They started, you know, their own sort of Smule Nation channel to try and aggregate those communities together, which were sort of broken up in different parts of the internet, including Facebook as groups. And so they raised another $16.6 million with a Roth Capital, Bessemer Venture Partners, Granite Ventures, and Shasta Ventures, and potentially eyeing an IPO. The capitalization is now $42 million. And so lots of interesting stuff happening at Smule. I actually want to get an interview with them at some point soon to work out what's going on there. So, you know, what's your take on music app and music games, and how come Smule has managed to break break this formula of doing this while so many companies have failed? And I know that personally because I work for one. So Andy, what are your thoughts?
They're not a company I know a huge amount about, but I know, you know, apps like T-Pain and AutoRap and things like that. There are things that I'm kind of vaguely aware of existing and always seemed like something that would have a really short shelf life, like something that would be entertaining for maybe an afternoon at most, maybe into a second day, but, you know, not long. But then, you know, obviously then they're saying they're building these, you know, this like kind of online community around people who are making music and collaborating on things. So maybe there is something there, and maybe, you know, you don't need to kind of hook in everyone in the world. If you can just get all the people who are kind of interested in doing that on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe there is a business there.
Stephen, I was at a meetup the other week at a company called Rolly, who work doing a really cool new product called the Seaboard. It's a new music keyboard. And so it was all about sort of music interaction and lots of people that are doing PhDs and interesting research around that. And there was somebody there that was talking about the fact that they see the next age of music as being more around the creation of content and sort of a democratization of the generative music space. And, you know, of course, Smule have managed to steer away from being completely tied to licensing deals. A lot of the stuff that they have is generated by the audience. Do you think that's a trend that we can see continuing? And having kids yourself, do you think that they might be interested in this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all a function of how good the apps are.
Right.
You know, it's and I agree with Andy. I mean, I was kind of shocked to see that $16.6 million. That seems like a lot to me for a music app on a phone. But these are cool apps, you know, the sing karaoke and various things. I can see them. I have a 12-year-old daughter. She hasn't used any of these in particular, I don't think. But she's constantly downloading apps and doing things, and she's super interested in music. So if there's one that catches her, yeah. I could see she's on Instagram and you know all the different Snapchat, all the different social networks, and so she's constantly doing these things. I could see this being a big deal, but I do think that Andy's point about this being a going concern in the future is very relevant. I mean,
yeah.
Think about, you know, Guitar Hero and Rock Band. 5 years ago, we thought that was the future of the music business. Like, look at this amazing new revenue stream. You know, we won't have to sell albums anymore. We'll just put our songs into Guitar Hero. And now where have they disappeared to? I mean, even I Am T-Pain, which is a bit of the Smule franchise app to an extent, you know, T-Pain has already left and come back since that app has come out. I mean, T-Pain used to be a gigantic star. I just did a story on him. He used to be a, you know, the biggest star in R&B and pop and hip hop. And then he went away for a while and now he's kind of making a comeback. So, you know, I just think that a lot of these apps are here today, gone tomorrow. And so it's going to depend on Smule's continuing ability to keep coming up with a cooler and better and more popular app to kind of regenerate and replace the next one. Will they do that? You know, obviously time will tell.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And moving on to a slightly less fun subject, there was an interesting move from Universal Music as the major label announced the acquisition of Eagle Rock Entertainment, a company specialized in the release of DVD concert videos and documentaries by mostly classic artists, including the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, and The Who. So Eagle Rock operates also two record labels, Eagle Records and Armory Records. So the Financial Times reported mostly on this. They reported that Lucian Grange, chief executive of Universal, said that expanding our audiovisual catalog and production expertise is critical as the company looks for other ways to exploit music-based content. So Eagle Rock's library contains nearly 2,000 hours of programming and more than 800 titles, and there's a big crossover between the artists that have released videos via Eagle Rock and Universal Music administered catalog. So that's definitely a bonus in terms of the crossover. And, you know, Eagle Rock hadn't really done a lot on the online video space, and it looks like a good opportunity for them to tie up with the already very well-developed Universal Music, you know, online video teams, and figure out what to do with this content online and how to monetize it. So this seems to be like an interesting development, because we were talking last week about Vivendi's sale of SFR and all the money they have, and the fact that, you know, Universal might start branching out into new avenues or trying to develop segments where it's not as strong a little bit more. So what do you make of the acquisition? And do you think it was weird because Eagle Rock is such a sort of old school company still, and but it does have a ton of cool content. So Andy?
Yeah, I think they are quite an old school company. I think that's right to say. They make a lot of good films. Like, yeah, that Rolling Stones film was really, really good. It's an interesting acquisition, and certainly it seemed to be one that, as well as catalog, it seemed to be one that they were, you know, doing for expertise as well. Because Universal has its own in-house TV production division, as far as I know. It was a bit of a surprise, but
yeah.
Yeah,
definitely
interesting.
Definitely very interesting, and you know, of course, we don't know the figures as well, so it could be a figure that wasn't that high for Universal to pay to get a hold of all that content.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, interestingly, they did take the two labels that the company owns, but not the publishing company.
Yeah,
which is now it's like spun out as its own standalone thing.
Yeah, no, it's very good you pointed that out as well. So, yeah, it was another sort of kink in the deal. And Steve, on your side, do you think that we're going to see labels try to get more expertise on the long-form video side of things, where, you know, they're pretty good now, of course, at doing short video clips, but they haven't got a huge amount of expertise on how to produce and market long-form content, and that might be a good source of revenue for them, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a gamble, I think. Again, like Andy said, you know, depending on how much they spent on the company on Eagle Rock, but it's a gamble, but I think it's a smart one. And we could look back in 5 or 10 years at this deal and say, wow, they were really shrewd, you know, the way they Universal partnered with Vivo and launched Vivo. I mean, video content is really interesting right now. I mean, 10 years ago, I would have said this was a bad idea because, you know, YouTube's just playing everything for free. And you know, there's no way anyone can make money off YouTube right now. And it seemed like there was this dormant period among content providers of, you know, what are we going to do with our music videos? What are we going to do with all this documentaries and behind the scenes content that we have and stuff? But, you know, in recent years, of course, YouTube has turned out to be through ads and through, you know, their content ID and all the various things that they do has become a pretty potent revenue generator for content companies and record labels in particular. So I could see, you know, taking, I mean, I've like you guys, I've seen some of the content on Eagle Rock and it's very good music content. And I could see them taking their, you know, their Nirvana documentary and slicing it up, either releasing it as a full thing on Netflix and trying to monetize it that way or slicing it up and saying, you know, here, YouTube Nirvana community, you know, that's more popular now that we've had the 20th anniversary of Kurt Cobain's passing, you know, this is hot content and exclusive content that no one's seen. So why don't you watch these snippets of this, you know, Dave Grohl interview or whatever, you know, and it gets a few million hits on YouTube and, or Vivo and, you know, everything's synergized and, you know, you get some money from ads.
Yeah.
So I can't see any individual play from this being a giant, like save the record industry thing. But it seems like if you collect a bunch of those little things, you know, it could be some significant revenue eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I was just going to say it's interesting that, I mean, Vivo has started putting up some more kind of longer form stuff. Like there was the Nine Inch Nails show that they put up. It was the end of last year. So it's certainly something that is not, you know, inconceivable.
Yeah. Absolutely. We'll see what happens with that. And I guess it's time to talk about Pono. We kind of have to because, you know, we talked about it a lot on the show in the last few weeks. It is a very interesting new development in the industry because nobody would have bet on it doing as well as it did. The Kickstarter campaign came to an end last night and the Neil Young-backed project shattered its 800K objective and raised $6.2 million in 30 days. The project had 18,220 backers. And according to what I calculated, which I hope is correct, it sold 15,148 devices with the other backers just buying t-shirts or signed posters or stuff like that, which was cheaper, of course, than the device itself. That was way above even my own projections. I said on the show before that, you know, 10,000 was the most I could see the unit selling, but it sold way more than that. So that's awesome. And of course, it's all down to the delivery of the product now and the delivery of a digital ecosystem that is going to be able to support that product and deliver high resolution files in a fairly, you know, decent catalog, you know, a large amount of tracks. And so what are your thoughts having the campaign concluded now? You know, we're not going to hear much about it until the product actually comes out to the market. But, you know, has it changed your mind around the product, seeing the excitement around it? Do you feel like, you know, 15,100 people is enough devices out there to create an ecosystem around this new digital service and just a bit of a roundup, really, Steve.
So basically, I mean, I think that this is a great thing for audiophiles.
Right.
Audiophiles have a lot of money. They will like the ecosystem of Pono, assuming it's relatively easy to use and it's somewhat as easy to use as your iPod or your iPhone or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Whether it goes mass, you know, to people who are already happy with the devices that they already listen to music on, I don't necessarily think the mass public of music listeners really cares that much about audio quality. You know, that's the big money. That's the big play.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to happen. And I don't think Neil really cares whether it happens either.
Yeah. No, I don't think he does. Andy, what are your thoughts? Did you buy one?
I think, you know, I didn't. I think Pono is just the most stupid thing in the world.
Okay.
They talked about in the when it came up to like 48 hours to go on the campaign, and they put out a statement saying, or an update on the, you know, to the backers saying, you know, this is starting a revolution in high quality music. And it's not. It's like the high quality digital music players have existed for a long time, and FLAC music files have existed for a long time, and all Pono is doing is selling a really expensive player that you can't even put in your pocket, and then getting you to buy really expensive FLAC files, which you have about four on your player. And it's just like, I don't understand why anyone would spend any money on it at all. Especially when, like, it looks so old fashioned and it's downloads. And you've got, like, Wimp in Norway who are doing, like, WAV audio streaming. Like, that seems like the area to go in, like, high quality streaming. Yeah. What? This just seems kind of, it seems like a very 2007 thing to do.
Yeah.
There's my soundbite for you.
Yeah, I think it's
interesting. Again, it sold $6.2 million, so there's some, well, I mean, maybe it's new Coke, you know, I don't know.
I realize that, you know, I'm shouting at something that's just made off money.
Yeah.
But I think it's
a huge debacle, I agree. But I don't know. They're audiophiles, they're always looking for something. They're ready to spend their money as long as they can get, you know, just this much little bit of sound quality that they perceive as being better. So
yeah. Well, I think that's it as well. Like, if you're walking around, you're going to have very good headphones to notice any kind of, increased level of sound quality as you walk around the park or whatever with the thing in your hand, because you can't put it in your pocket. And I don't understand. And I wonder how much of, you know, the people buying it was like trying to buy into something, it's almost like giving money to Neil Young rather than like actually buying into, you know, some high quality music.
Yeah.
Revolution.
I think like an interesting thing to look at, actually, let me just pull it up real quick, was the fact that there were all these devices that were linked to a particular artist. So there were, I think, 500 devices each for each of the artists, and there was a long list actually of artists that put their signature up for these devices to be signed by them, essentially in the metal. So for example, you got people like Patti Smith and Buffalo Springfield, Emmylou Harris, Pearl Jam, Grateful Dead, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jackson Brown, Neil Young, Arcade Fire, a bunch of artists, and that was interesting to see how many devices those sold as well. I mean, of course, it kind of came down to demographics in a sense, because some artists completely sold out other 500 devices, and some artists didn't sell that many. But even the demographic side of things doesn't really make sense, because for example, a band like Foo Fighters, which would have had a much younger demographic than Neil Young himself, they only had 8 devices left out of the 500. And so it must mean that a lot of Foo Fighter fans actually went out and bought the device. So I don't know, I'm kind of confused as to what makes sense of, how to make sense of this. But I just wanted to sort of point out there were, you know, thousands of devices sold off the back of these sort of signed special limited edition things, which.
But maybe what's going on here, you know, I'm speculating too, because like you guys, I'm kind of confused about the appeal of this. But maybe what's going on is the same reason that you, as a Nine Inch Nails fan, will buy an expensive $200 box set when you can just get all the music for free or very cheaply somewhere else. You know, it's like you want a thing. You want to buy. Here I have a Tom Petty signed, cool looking pyramid-shaped device that Neil Young himself has endorsed that I can put on my desk, and, you know, I personally wouldn't want that. I can't afford it, but, you know, there are people who probably, it's like a high-end gizmo gadget that will, you know, add to the decor of their home or their personal fashion in some way. You know, I don't know. I think that there's something about a physical something or other that people still like and maybe are even desperate for in this time when there aren't that many things like that in the music world. I don't know.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, it was interesting today. There was some research that came out today ahead of Record Store Day where they found that kind of like 26% of young, like I think it was 18 to 24 possibly, or 25 to 34. It was the younger demographic of record buyers were buying music with no intention of ever playing it. They just wanted a thing.
They just want a thing. Sure. That makes sense.
And I mean, I was talking about ecosystems. So 15,000 people, if, you know, these are people that are willing to spend, you know, $200-$400 a year in music, then, you know, if it becomes, you know, $6-$10 million a year business in terms of music transactions, that would be definitely a sustainable business. If those people only spend, you know, $50 or $100 a year on Pono's, you know, music store files, then that becomes a little bit more difficult to make the math sort of come together. So we're going to literally have to wait and see when everything launches and when the devices are shipped, how everything comes together. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Kim.com. So Kim.com, there's been a bunch of news this week around him, which was interesting. And Steve, I know that you wrote a piece as well on Rolling Stone just yesterday, I think, that got posted around the story. So first of all, the first news was that the MPAA and the RIAA posted new lawsuits against Kim.com during last week. The MPAA earlier in the week and the RIAA followed a little bit later. This is eyeing up the assets that Kim.com had that were seized, essentially, the mega upload assets that were frozen. And so, of course, if these companies were to get awarded a part of those frozen assets, of course, that would be a pretty good payout for them. You know, he's accused of a bunch of different things, from, of course, copyright infringement to also money laundering and a bunch of other different charges. And so that's the one side of the story. So, Steve, on your end, why do you think that the labels are keeping at it and really not relenting on this fight?
I mean, the basic reason, you know, I talked to a few, the RIAA didn't want to talk for the story I wrote, and of course Kim.com didn't talk either. But so the experts that I talked to basically said the labels just think they can get money.
Yeah.
They think that there's a way to get money out of this, and or at least it's worth trying to get money. I mean, you know, I think I sort of mentioned this in my piece, but right now, aside from the money that the labels, you know, perceive him to have infringed and the money that he's gotten away with through copyright infringement, he is sort of like a blessing to content companies right now, because here's this guy with a giant face who is just out there going, you know, I'm the villain, I'm the bad guy. It's like what the labels wished LimeWire and Kazaa would have been, or, you know, Napster 10 or 15 years ago. Like, okay, fine, we're just, it's like, it's this giant pinata, and they're going to, okay, we'll take the baseball bat and we'll just take a few whacks at it, you know, and hopefully some money will come out.
Yeah.
And so it's great. The record industry, I mean, this ship has really sailed, I think. The record industry and to an extent the movie industry have even moved beyond illegal downloading to an extent. I mean,
yeah,
they're already onto these new models where it's almost not even as relevant as it used to be. And I know I'm kind of maybe jumping the gun on that a little bit. But so if you can say, hey, here's the villain, I'm going to attack the villain, you know, that's always good.
Although,
I think it's a win-win for these content companies.
Although I would argue that, strangely, as much as, you know, there are a lot of shady things that have happened around mega upload over time, Kim.com has kind of become like this really likable character. So, Andy, do you think that can be a backlash of this whole sort of demonization of him, is the fact that he actually turned out to be a really open and talkative guy that actually a lot of people end up liking after they talked to him?
Yeah, I definitely think he's become kind of the cuddly face of file sharing.
Yeah.
he's got a lot of fans. I follow him on Twitter. He's got a lot of people who you know, think he's absolutely in the right and follow everything he does. And now he's launched his own political party.
Yeah.
I mean, admittedly, like, he's doing all this stuff in New Zealand, so kind of there's not a lot of people there to vote for him. But it is interesting how he has become this kind of fun... I mean, he was a funny figure anyway, but he's a kind of this fun figure. In terms of the lawsuit, I think obviously the MPAA just gave up waiting for his extradition and just kind of have gone, like, you know, this criminal case may never, ever happen. Let's just get our civil case out of the way.
Yeah.
And then I think the record labels have gone, oh, well, if they're doing it, we'll have a go as well.
Yeah.
Might as well.
Yeah, exactly. We might as well get some money and not be left out in the cold if the MPAA does get a ruling in its favor.
Yeah.
So the other story about Kim.com was the fact that it was a big story, actually, today. A high court in Auckland, New Zealand, denied the Crown's application for an extension of the freezing order on Kim.com's New Zealand assets. So he's got millions of dollars as well as cars and a bunch of assets in New Zealand. And it seemed like the court couldn't find really grounds to extend this freezing of his assets beyond the 2 years that they've already been frozen for. And of course, you know, there's still grounds for appeal, I think, at the moment. But if the ruling stands in 2 weeks, Kim.com could get his assets back. And he immediately tweeted, you know, the asset ruling is huge. We've just filed a case in Hong Kong against the unlawful seizure of Mega Upload. The US case is falling apart. And also he said, you know, our assets were seized for 800 days and I was still able to fight back even with my hands tied behind my back. Imagine what I can do now. So that's definitely a big statement here saying, you know, if I get my money back and I can actually hire a ton of lawyers to look after my cases, then it's going to become really difficult for the prosecution in both New Zealand, the US, and in Hong Kong to actually carry on with the case. What do you make of it? And on your end, you know, can you see ever him being extradited to the United States, Steve?
I don't know. I'm not as enamored of Kim as a cuddly public figure, I guess. I think it's funny. I think his story is interesting, but you know, I do think in the end he pretty clearly and I'm not, you know, I'm not a record label shill or anything like sure. that. I think that they've done a lot of stupid things over the years, but you know, I think it's pretty obvious that this guy profited off of, you know, illegal copyright infringement, which is something I think was a pretty obvious case of it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that this judgment in New Zealand was a huge victory. There's still an appeal left to go. You know, it's just basically has to do with getting some of his fortune back. You
right.
know, I think that his declarations of victory and I'm the cuddly face of file sharing and stuff like that, I think that's, he's just riding it as long as he can, you know, and eventually it's going to come to an end, I think. I see him as being somebody who is making a lot of hay out of this stuff. But in the end, you know, if you look at the things that he's accused of doing and many of the things that he's kind of admitted to doing, I don't think it's good. I think that most people will eventually kind of realize that.
Yeah, yeah. Mandy, do you think that this will put a brakes in you know, in the cases that are going on around the world if he gets a lot of money to actually hire, you know, an army of lawyers at this point?
I agree. Like, obviously, you know, he's become this figure of this kind of, you know, fun figure because that's how he's presenting himself.
Yeah.
And as you know, as much as, you know, on a daily basis, him and his lawyer are putting out statements every time anything happens in any of the many cases against him. You know, him and his lawyer come out and say, well, this just proves that the case against us is completely groundless and it's going to fail. I mean, and that is, you know, it's not got to court. This, you know, it's just talk at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not like they're kind of presenting huge amounts of evidence to the contrary. They're just saying, you know, we're going to win.
Yeah.
If he hires 10 more lawyers, they're just going to say, well, we're going to win.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's not going to make much sense.
You know, the movie industry has a lot of money as well. So
yeah,
it's kind of, he's still got something tough to go up against if and when he gets extradited.
Yeah, and I wanted to finish, not to finish, but the last story we're going to comment on was just talking briefly about Pablo Soto. So, and he was the creator of the software Blobster and Piolet and Manolito, which were P2P software that were very popular sort of in the late 2000s in Spain, but also around the world. Soto got sued in 2008 by Universal, Sony, EMI, and Warner, and Promusica, which is the Spanish RIAA, and because essentially, you know, they said he was facilitating copyright infringement, and of course that wasn't good. I actually met him in 2008, I think, in Berlin, just as the lawsuit was filed, and now several years later, Spain actually has reiterated what seemed to be kind of the country's stance on this, which is the fact that his activities were not all neutral but perfectly legal and were protected by Article 38 of the Spanish Constitution. This, of course, clears Soto of any wrongdoing, and Soto didn't make anywhere near as much money as Kim.com from his activities, so his was definitely a much tougher fight from a legal perspective when it comes to funding it. He is going to release more software now that this has been said. But there is, you know, an ongoing problem in Spain of illegal, of copyright infringement, because it seems like the vast majority of content that is exchanged in Spain is illegally copied or transmitted via P2P networks of some sort of or another. So it's kind of hard here. You know, it was kind of the big major is against the one developer, but at the same time, you know, there is an ongoing problem of piracy in Spain at the moment. So what do you guys make of it, and how do you think we could get out of this funk in Spain, but also in other countries where it seems like P2P is essentially legalized? Anybody wants to take this as the last one?
Well, it's an interest. I think any legal case in Spain related to file sharing is interesting because it's everything kind of plays out so differently there to how it has in the rest of Europe.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there was the research recently that said since 2001, revenues, you know, music revenues in Spain, record revenues, have dropped by 80% because, you know, file sharing is so... It continues to be so prevalent, and they passed a law in 2007 to allow web blocking like we've had over here. And obviously, you know, we've always said web blocking isn't particularly effective, and I think that's proved to be the case in Spain. You know, file sharing is as popular as ever. But then for a court to say, well, you know, there's nothing illegal about this.
Yeah.
Makes it a lot harder to fight.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, Steve, on your front, you know, how do you feel about this? You know, again, it was a case of a bit of a perception play here for the music industry, you know, filing a lawsuit against a relatively small company and developer here. But you know, what do you feel is going to come of this? And do you feel like Spain is a country that can be rescued when it comes to getting people to pay for content when they've been so used to exchanging via P2P networks for a long time?
I mean, I don't know that. I don't know as much as Andy does about Spain and its feelings towards illegal file sharing and copyright and so forth. But it certainly does seem like an anomaly. I mean, this is sort of the only significant court decision that since Napster, really, that's come to this conclusion that a P2P network, you know, isn't responsible for the illegal activities of its users. You know, certainly that was something that the U.S. courts dealt with all the way up to the Supreme Court, and in great detail when they were dealing with companies like Grokster and Napster and LimeWire and so forth.
Yeah.
The one interesting side note, maybe Andrea, you remember more about this than I do, but I remember this coming up in my book research. Mr. Soto had some discussions with the major labels for a while. He met with some executives at Sony, and they were interested in sort of potentially licensing his software, his Napster-like software, after they'd sort of realized that they missed the boat on the original Napster. I remember that coming into play. And of course, this was 2003 or something, so, you know, it never went anywhere. But I remember this character. I remember him being interesting.
That's interesting. I didn't know it went as far back as 2003, actually. I missed that.
Yeah, it could be. I'm just doing that from memory. But yeah. But to your question, I mean, you know, I'm not sure how this affects. It seems like Spain perhaps is a bit of a lost cause for content providers. You know, they, certainly if their top court is saying, you know, this sort of a service is okay, you know, something that contradicts all the decisions, all the precedents in the U.S. and most of Europe and elsewhere, you know, maybe there's not a lot you can do about it.
Yeah,
you know, maybe you just have to wait for things to change, if you're a content company.
I guess it really comes down to how the software makers themselves decide to position their service. You know, I think if somebody like Soto said, you know, I'm going to release a new version of Blobster, for example, and I'm going to try and behave a little bit more like BitTorrent in trying to work with artists and providing ways for artists to monetize against the content they're distributing on P2P networks and making that ecosystem a little bit more monetizable and a little bit more interesting on the commercial front, that could be something that's good, I guess, if P2P is already so established. But if it keeps being a question of exchanging files freely without there being any sort of way to tie that in back into the industry and helping out artists, then it becomes a little bit of a harder argument to make, I think.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens with that. And so finally, a couple of months back, we had a brief chat about the latest rate court decisions in the US, but none of us was particularly well informed about this. So I called up Deborah Newman, the founder of MusicStrat, who's very well versed in these matters, to explain what's happening in the US. So here's my chat with her for anybody who is interested in an overview of what's going on in the States in terms of internet radio payments, both on the master and on the publishing side. Well, it's a real pleasure today to have Deborah Newman joining me on the show. Deborah is the founder of MusicStrat, a strategic consulting company focused on the intersection of music, technology, and the law. So hi, Deborah, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. Thank you, Andrea. Nice to be here.
So it's a real pleasure to have you today. And I wanted to have you on the show, on the main show, because essentially every time we come up to the issues around raid courts and the news surrounding that, we have a really hard time debating it amongst ourselves, because many of us don't actually know exactly what we're talking about. Even if I've been covering this space for quite some time, it's still hard to get the words lined up in the correct way so that I don't say things that are totally inaccurate. So definitely great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining me.
Nice to be here. That's great. I think your interviews are really excellent, and I'm pleased to be able to finally do this with you.
That's great. Thank you. And so essentially, I wanted to talk about, first of all, the most recent development, which was the ruling in the Raid Court ASCAP case, which came up just after actually I'd recorded all my interviews at South by Southwest, which is a bit of a shame because it meant that that didn't really enter in the conversation. But it means that we can talk about it now. So the Raid Court. First of all, give us a little bit of a background around the MusicStrat so that we understand where you're coming from when, you, when you're giving your thoughts on these matters.
So MusicStrat is my consulting company. Right. I, as you probably know, I've spent my entire career in the music business, not always as a lawyer. I'm actually more of a recent lawyer. I spent 20 years at CBS Records, which became Sony Music along the way. And that was more on the creative side in the music video area. That's really where I sort of made my name. And then I left Sony in early 94 and got involved in the very early days of the digital and online music business in the 90s, went through the dot-com boom and bust in the 90s. And in 2001, decided that the action, I was the head of marketing in those days, but there was so much going on in the area of rights and licensing as new kinds of services, digital distribution was happening. And I could see that those battles were the gating factor of what was going to happen success-wise with some of these companies. And I decided to go back to school and get my law degree and focus specifically on copyright, entertainment, and what at the time they were calling cyber law, which is really internet law and communications law. And so I went to law school from 2002 to 2005 and finally passed the bar, and in 2008 sort of started my consultant practice. And mostly I work on the side of the startups on the digital music services and helping them understand copyright, understand the sort of ecosystem of the music business and the rights that are implicated by what they're doing, and then help them get the licenses they need in order to operate or to launch a service that they're doing. So I work a lot with startups.
Awesome. And so so to pick up on what I was talking about, so the ruling in the ASCAP case in the Raid Courts, of course, I want to talk briefly about that, and then we can move on to talking about the disparity between master royalties and publishing royalties, and also talk about the Songwriters Equity Act that has just been introduced. And so first of all, talking about this, what are your thoughts on the ruling? For people that haven't listened to a previous show where we did cover this in a little bit anyway, ASCAP will receive 1.85% of Pandora's annual revenue. This is a lot lower than ASCAP was hoping, and just a little bit higher than what Pandora was hoping. So from your point of view, where does this leave us in terms of how the space is going to move?
Well, first of all, this ruling only applies to the period of 2011 to 2015. So we have a year and a half of under this rate. And what it sort of did was save Pandora retroactively from having to pay more, because what they wanted was a scaled up rate up to 3% for the prior years, 2011. So Pandora, you know, won in that case. The main argument, one of the arguments that was going on, which was where Pandora wanted to be, although it may have just been a negotiating ploy, was to be at the same rate that terrestrial radio pays for songwriters.
Right.
So under the Radio Music Licensing Committee, RMLC, that negotiated rate was 1.7%. And a big point that Ken Steinthal, Pandora's, I went to the opening argument, so that was kind of fun to be there on a blizzard day one day, argued was that there was a quirk in the law that allows terrestrial radio companies who own internet radio services to pay the same rate for internet radio services that they do for their broadcast radio stations.
Right.
And specifically, Clear Channel, which is the largest owner of terrestrial radio in the United States, owns, I don't know, 1,800 stations or something like that, also operates iHeartRadio, which is a direct competitor to Pandora in the same space, well-funded, and they pay 1.7%. And so that was really one of Pandora's main arguments. So why should they be paying more than iHeartRadio? The court saw that and appreciated that and looked at the definition under the consent decree of what are, quote, similarly situated stations or similarly situated businesses, and found that they were not, because of a number of sort of complex factors, exactly similarly situated, and did not give Pandora that lower rate. But they definitely, I mean, it was sort of a compromise, and in that sense, Pandora won, but you could say that ASCAP at least had something to say that they won, because the rate didn't get pushed down. It only stayed the same.
Yeah.
But what's going to happen going forward is a complete unknown, because these rates are going to end up being changed again. The standards by which the rates are set is a big issue in terms of the factors that are looked at. And Pandora won, as did all the internet radio services that operate under that ASCAP rate of 1.85% for the moment. But it's a complete unknown as to what's going to happen next.
Yeah, sure. And this is just one of the two main trials that were going on in this space. There's the BMI one is actually a few months behind, or at least a couple of months behind as far as timing is concerned. So that ruling could be expected sometimes this summer, you think?
Well, the BMI, this particular case with BMI probably won't actually go to trial until the end of the year.
Right.
And there probably won't be a decision on BMI until next year.
Okay.
And we're talking 2015 already. I'm not sure. I'd have to go look and see if the time frame for the BMI rate period is the same as ASCAP's, if it matches that 2011 to 2015. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
But the arguments are basically the same. And BMI's rate Pandora has been paying less than the published rate that BMI has in their non-interactive performance licenses is actually higher right now than ASCAP's rate.
Yeah. And so the key issue now that I guess that I see is the fact that on the one side, you know, we're kind of stuck when it comes to publishing to these very minor rates, which have prompted, lots of songwriters to cry foul around how the system has been established. We saw a tweet by Bette Midler even last week talking about the royalties that she received for her tracks that were been played millions of times on the service. What we're trying to figure out here is the balance between the master recording and the songwriters. The Songwriter Equity Act is one of the most interesting things that we've seen come up in the last few months, which does try to give a little bit of a better slice of the pie to the songwriters. So what does the Songwriter Equity Act do? Are you pro or against? And also, you know, what can be done to increase the publisher's percentage, which is really low, without really making the services pay anymore? Because that's a key question mark, right? You know, the services are already paying through the nose and struggling to be profitable with the rates they're paying right now. So, of course, we don't want to jack up all of the rates, but I think songwriters probably deserve a little bit more than what they're getting right now.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, first of all, there are two different publishing rates at issue here. One is the what's called Section 114, which is what a Pandora operates under, which is the streaming licensing. And then there's the mechanical rate, which is Section 115, right, which determines the publishing rate for on-demand services, as well as for the sale of CDs and to the CDs per song rate. So that rate, like Spotify, for example, or RDO or Rhapsody or any of the on-demand services, pays also a statutory rate for publishing. It's different from the Pandora rate. The Songwriters Equity Act is an attempt to change the standard by which the rates are determined from what's called this is a little complicated, the 801B, which is an analysis of a number of factors, the 801B standard, to a willing buyer, willing seller standard, which allows marketplace deals that are done, like deals that have been done in the past between Sony and Pandora or EMI and various services, to be used in the setting of the rates, and those rates have been higher. So it's a tug of war in terms of the rate, the standard by which the rates are set. What is the big issue is, as you said, the services themselves are desperately trying to blossom and grow and remain profitable. So do these new, if the rates for publishing get raised, does it come out of the sound recording rates? Does that rate get lowered? You know, who's the one who pays it? Does the service end up paying it? Do the record companies, the sound recordings owners have to give a little bit for the publishers to get more? That is completely unclear right now. And I think that, you know, from the standpoint, perspective, since I represent the digital music services, most of whom are not in the Pandora profit, you know, well, Pandora's not profitable either, but that's money yet. And for them, these rates are onerous if they're just starting. They're startups, they're bootstrapped, they're raising money from friends and family, and these rates can be very, very onerous to them. So, and I think that the court recognizes that this is still a new business that has not evolved and is not yet profitable. And so that's where the tension lies, and nobody's going to want to give, and I think we see a battle coming up. Yeah. One of the things that's also happening is the Copyright Royalty Board, CRB, which is the entity that sets the rates for Pandora for streaming services that are collected, administered, and collected by Sound Exchange, that is going to start very soon. So the right. new sound recording rates are also going to be up, you know, for grabs. So it's all sort of happening in a, you know, in the same time frame where the battle over the split on these rates. I mean, there is some evidence to say that the sound recording royalties are in some cases as much as five times the publishing royalties. Yeah. And, you know, that's out of whack. So who pays more and who gets cut and who pays more? And that, we don't know that yet.
Yeah. And I think there's also, there's a couple of different things that also I wanted to look at. One of them is the sort of the politics around Sound Exchange as well. So in your experience, is Sound Exchange, does it behave as an independent body? Is it closely tied to the record labels which receive a share of you know, what's paid by the services? How does Sound Exchange behave when it comes to these negotiations? Could it be open to a slight lowering of the rates if it means that the publishers are going to get more, or is it completely you know, in a standoff position, we're not going to allow the rates to be lowered?
Well, Sound Exchange was created by the record industry to collect, administer, and collect the rates that were granted under the Digital Performance and Sound Recording Act. When the first rights were granted to be able to allow the owners of the sound recordings to monetize the sound recordings in digital radio. And as you know, terrestrial radio does not pay anything for the use of the sound recording. That also is in now up in the discussion, because the whole area of—I know I'm digressing for a second—but the whole area of copyright reform or modernization is on the table, and because of this disparity, a lot of things that people are now looking at, and it's serious. I mean, for years this has been attempted to be passed, and the radio industry, National Association of Broadcasters, NAB, has been a very powerful lobby and has been able to prevent it from being passed. Now, with new copyright legislation, there is a better chance that terrestrial radio will have to pay something.
Yeah.
So first of all, if that's the case, if terrestrial radio pays something, I believe that the pressure to raise the rates for digital will be somewhat relieved if the performers and record companies are actually getting some money from an area they've never had before. That's one thing. Sound Exchange doesn't set rates. Sound Exchange represents the labels and certainly has a lobbying power and very strong, but they basically administer and collect the monies that are set by the CRB.
Sure.
So, you know, it's what's really interesting is the battle between the publishing industry and the record industry. And in many cases, the large publishing companies are owned by the large record industry. So to some degree, it's an internal battle between divisions at major labels, which is, I think, sort of bizarre.
Yeah.
But it also comes down to which contributors to the music we listen to are the ones that make, that are going to make the most money. Is it going to be the performer or is it going to be the songwriter?
Yeah. One last thing that I wanted to ask you about was the fact that there's a fundamental difference between the distribution of money between the money that gets given to the master side and the publishing side when it comes to this internet radio services. Because if we look at Sound Exchange, we know that X amount goes directly to the artist and X amount goes to the label, which is a kind of a very different take on how royalties are usually paid. They're usually paid to the label and then they pay a percentage of that to the artist. Whilst on the publishing side, that doesn't happen. So on the publishing side, the royalties get paid to ASCAP or BMI. They go into that big black box and then they get paid to the publisher and then they have to trickle down to the songwriter. Do you think that's a major problem when it comes to songwriters actually getting paid from these services? And are we going to see songwriters trying to get a bit of a clearer idea of how many plays they've had and really understand a little bit more about how much money they're getting and why they're getting it?
Well, first of all, songwriters who administer their own publishing and who don't grant those rights to a third-party publisher do get paid directly from the performing rights organization.
Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, of course.
Always that they give it to the publishers, but the publishers traditionally sign songwriters and have a split between what they collect between them and the songwriters and take an administration fee because there's a lot of other things that publishers do. So, that model is not unlike the record company that gives an advance to an artist and goes through the process of making the record and selling it and marketing it and whatever. I don't know if that payments directly to the songwriters is going to evolve like the way Sound Exchange pays performers directly. That's a good question. It's certainly performers are getting money if they sign up to Sound Exchange, which a lot of them don't even know that they could. So Sound Exchange sits on a lot of money that's not given away because they don't know where to send it.
Yeah.
But that's actually a great asset for songwriters. What I think will be even more interesting is if and when terrestrial radio pays a royalty, will it be structured like the Sound Exchange digital royalty? Who will actually collect it? How will it be distributed? You know, that's another whole piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, and there's going to be a big battle around that, I'm sure.
I'm sure, because there are going to be a lot of people vying for Harry Fox, you know, a lot of people vying for being in that business. The issue of data and transparency is a big one. And I think some of the services are trying very hard to create a more transparent back end for rights holders, including songwriters, to be able to go in and see their plays, the usage of their music, of their rights.
Right.
It's still very complicated because, especially on the publishing side, the rights information is very complex. And as you know, in many cases, you can have 4, 5, 6, many, many songwriters on one song. And there's no one central database where anybody can actually go and see what who the writers are.
Yeah.
And this is a problem that is being talked about a lot. It hasn't been fixed yet. But all of these organizations have their own databases and they're matching the sound recording to the songwriters. And, you would like to think that everybody gets paid on a what's called a census basis for the actual use of their music on a per song per play, but it doesn't quite work like that.
There are
formulas the performing rights organizations use to pay, and I don't understand the formulas well enough because they're all different. Yeah. But at some point, we have to get to a point where it is transparent and where usage is paid based on actual usage and not on some formula based on some relative in other media usage or however it's done right now, which is very unclear because nobody will reveal.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Deborah, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show today, and I'll definitely have you back on when and if, I'm sure news will come up in this field. It's bound to come up. So, thanks so much again for coming on the show.
That's great, Andrea, and I'm sure I'll see you at some convention again soon in the future.
Absolutely. And you can find all the information about MusicStrat on musicstrat.com. Is that correct? And Deborah's handle, in case you're not watching the video version, is at Deb Newman on Twitter. Thanks so
much.
And that's all for this week. Hey guys, it was a real pleasure having you on. And so I want to hear about what you're working on. And Stevie, you said that you just wrote a great piece for the New York Times Magazine, right?
I did. It's my first piece ever for the New York Times. It's about Sia Furler, the pop singer who now writes songs for David Guetta and Christina Aguilera and Beyonce and so forth. And I'm excited. I've never been in the New York Times before, so this is kind of a thrill for me. It's supposed to come out Sunday, and we'll see what the reaction is.
Yeah, she made like a proper comeback, right, in the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, her thing is that she was a singer herself, and she was getting more and more popular, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, and then all of a sudden she kind of abruptly changed her idiom, and she decided that she would be a songwriter for other people. So she sort of does it in reverse. She, like, I was on track to being a pop star, and now I've just decided that I'm going to go behind the scenes and, you know, make a lot of money but not be famous. And so that it became sort of the gist of the story, the socially phobic pop star.
It's not a bad thing to do, actually. You know, you still make money and you don't have to tour, and so that's not a bad thing.
That's exactly that's her thing, and it's working. So
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
and Andy, on your front, anything you want to plug? Of course, The Great Escape's coming up and you guys are working on that.
Yeah, I have to mention The Great Escape. When are we? We're very, very close to it now. So that's the 8th and the 10th of May in Brighton. We're just kind of right now putting the last touches on the conference that we program every year.
Yeah.
We've rejigged it a bit this year. It's going to be different. It's kind of going to be six strands focusing on different topics in the music industry. So everything, there'll be kind of interviews and discussions and presentations and things all in each, you know, in grouped into each strand. And we've also got a couple of mini conferences. One of them is the DIY conference that we did last year. It's kind of aimed at new musicians trying to get into the music industry, and delegates at The Great Escape get access to that, but you can buy standalone tickets as well. And then this year we're launching a mini tech conference called Blueprint, which is kind of looking at stuff I guess would be of interest to digital music trends listeners and viewers.
Awesome.
The exciting thing we're doing in that is that we just announced is Who Sampled are doing a sample-thon, which they're describing as like a hack day for musicians, and they've cleared this huge catalog of samples for people to come in and, like, over the course of the day just make music.
That's very cool, and yeah, definitely going to keep an eye out for that. And we're trying to sort out some sort of recording of DNT at The Great Escape, so hopefully that's going to happen, and that's going to be awesome. And so look out for that in the week that the festival is happening, if you can't make it down to Brighton. Of course, we have a lot of listeners in the US as well. And well, it was a real pleasure having you on once again. Thanks so much for coming on. And don't forget to check out the DNT one-to-one. Well, I'm talking to the listeners now, I guess. It's kind of hard to explain that. But yeah, for the listeners, thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to check out the DMT one-to-one show again, which comes out every week interviewing interesting companies working in the space. Last week I had StageBlock, and this week I have an interview with a new social music app called Lucky Penny, which is currently being featured in the App Store on the Music Discovery apps category. So just go to digitalmusictrends.com and follow the links to the one-to-one show. Thanks so much for listening once again. Have a fantastic week, and till next time.